Scott, I wanted to ask you, first off, about responsible wealth. It's not often that we hear of members of the top 5% getting involved in economic reform. What brings a person like yourself into a position to address these issues?
Well, responsible wealth was formed 3 years ago as we went around the country doing educational work on the growing economic divide. We found increasingly a number of wealthy people coming forward and saying, I've benefited from all these rules that have changed, that have led the rich to grow richer and everyone else to struggle to maintain their standard of living. And is there anything we can do as a group of affluent people? And so and many people came together. Right now we have 450 members who are trying to find ways that they can speak out in kind of surprising ways about taxes and living wages and corporate compensation, things like that, to try and effect change to reduce economic polarization in America.
Now, you've actually had a fairly diverse career. You've worked in the corporate sector, you've worked in a group home, and you've been dumpster diving for food in D.C.
Right.
How did you come to take part in all these diverse activities?
Well, I think I've been very fortunate to have a lot of different opportunities to experience life in different ways. Actually, the dumpster diving scenario was one that very much changed my life. I was trying to work with a homeless shelter and feed 500 people each evening, and what they would do is go out and look for food behind supermarkets in the dumpsters that was being thrown away. And in one particular dumpster, at 5 o'clock in the morning, I jumped in and there was a homeless man already in there eating his breakfast. And he told me that, don't worry, there's plenty here for all of us. Don't be afraid. And he helped me pick out the best food in the dumpster for other homeless people who would be eating later that evening. And that really affected me in a very profound way, to understand that there really is enough for all of us in the society, and it's a question of how we distribute it and share it amongst each other. And so that's kind of been a theme that's led me into all the different kinds of work I've done and has led me here to work at Responsible Wealth.
Now, the Responsible Wealth Project has cited a fair tax system as a cornerstone of democracy. As it relates to a democracy, how is a fair tax system necessary for that?
Well, we think that when we think about American history, one of the things that strikes us is that the founding families that came to this country from Europe were really trying to escape an economic aristocracy where your future was determined by what family you were born into, not by your gifts or your talents. And we think that the America is in danger of kind of returning to that economic aristocracy when we see these huge concentrations of wealth that are building up in America, largely because of changes in the tax system, where we've dramatically reduced the tax rates on wealthy families. We've cut capital gains taxes. There's a move afoot to eliminate the estate tax, which is a very important part of a progressive tax structure, that a tax that falls on just 2% of American families. All of these things have allowed massive amounts of wealth to concentrate in the hands of a very few narrow sliver of society. At the same time, working people have found their tax burden rising, particularly as payroll taxes, Social Security taxes have gone up, as well as sales taxes that fall more heavily on low and moderate income people than on upper income people. And so we're working to try and change those things. We fought at the repeal of the estate tax in September. We're going to organize people to speak out against repealing the estate tax when it comes up under President Bush's administration. We think it'll come up as an early agenda item for him. And so these are the kinds of efforts we work on to try and assure a more fair economy.
And of course, President Bush, his main platform was tax relief, enormous tax relief. I would imagine that that's going to go mostly to the rich and the industrialists.
Right. The largest amount, I think 42%, is slated to go to the top 1% of taxpayers, which is a very large amount and even a greater amount than the top 1% pay in taxes. I believe they pay around 30% of the tax burden, and they're going to get 42% of the tax cuts. So even if one says the rich pay more already, then giving them even a greater tax cut than their share of the tax burden doesn't make any sense in a society that's trying to reduce economic inequality.
You've certainly got your work cut out for you there.
I think we do, but hopefully we'll get this message to others through shows like yours and other media outlets.
Tell me a little bit about the shareholder resolution campaign.
Sure. Responsible Wealth members have acted in a variety of ways And one of the things they have is ownership of stock, since they are affluent Americans. And while some of our efforts try to change things legislatively, our shareholder campaign is focused on changing corporate policies. One of the areas where we can see economic inequality most clearly is in the corporate sector, where Business Week annually does a survey of the ratio of CEO pay to average worker pay. In 1999, the ratio between the average large company CEO and the average manufacturing worker reached 475 times. In 1980, that was only 42 times. So we've seen a tenfold increase in the disparity between corporate leaders and the rest of the people in the corporation. Responsible Wealth has decided to try and focus some attention and discussion, stimulate some discussion on this subject. So we've looked at a variety of different issues, one of which is companies that have increased their CEO's pay significantly during periods of downsizing and cost cutting. And we've tried to ask the question of, you know, does it make sense when a company's in the cost cutting mode and people are being told to tighten their belts, to have costs in the executive suite continue to go, continue to rise in a handsome sort of way. We don't think that makes sense for the company, for the shareholder, certainly for the employee morale. We've looked at other companies where the CEOs have failed to meet their objectives and have been forced out or asked to resign by boards of directors, and yet as those people have been let go or resigned, they've received huge pension, huge severance pay packages in the tens of millions of dollars. We think this is counter to everything that corporations talk about in terms of rewarding good performance with high pay. It rewards bad performance for high pay, and again sends a very poor message to the rest of the employee base, as well as to shareholders, and certainly to the leaders that come after these leaders that have failed. What incentive do they have to succeed if they know that they fail? They still get a very large payout. We've also tried to look at ways to increase employee ownership. There's a lot of studies that have been done by the academic world that suggest that giving all employees a stake gives them all a mentality of being owners, in a sense of being able to succeed from the wealth that they create together. So we've introduced some shareholder resolutions in that area.
Definitely something needed in a time of recession-era layoffs and enormous pay increases for CEOs.
Right.
You're also calling for pay equity report, particularly, I guess, women and people of color, even those who've moved into the corporate sector and the executive level, are still saying they're receiving less pay for the same work.
Right. The United States has made some progress in this area. 20 years ago, the average woman made about 60 cents on a dollar compared to the average man. Now it's up to close to 75 cents, but it's still quite a disparity. There's been a growing number of lawsuits on wage inequity, both to women and people of color. And so we think it's a risk for companies, and we've asked companies, the Federal Equal Opportunity Employment Commission has put out voluntary pay equity audits that they've asked all companies that are federal contractors to perform. And so we've introduced a resolution to ask companies to implement that voluntary pay equity audit, both because it's the right thing to do, as well as to protect companies against possible future liability from lawsuits and negative damage to their reputation.
Let's talk a little bit about broadened ownership. The resolution in question, it asks for companies to establish employee stock ownership plans and sort of distribute the wealth that way.
Right. Our plan this year in that area is a resolution we introduced with Walt Disney. And what we've asked Walt Disney to do is to limit the amount of stock options that they give to their top executives, Michael Eisner, their CEO, as well as their other top executives. Typically, companies have given huge amounts of stock options to a very small number of people, and Disney is certainly a prime example of that. The resolution we filed has asked them to give no more than 5% of their total options to any single executive and no more than 10% of the options to the group of executives. Disney has tens of thousands of employees all over the world. Most of them get no stock options. We think the company would be stronger if those options were spread around more and that more people felt a sense of ownership in the company.
You've also called for a sort of democracy within corporations, real elections, whereas the members of the boards are chosen not simply from other CEO peers.
Right. We've just come through a very intense and revealing election process for president. Most Americans don't think about it, but corporate boards of directors are not really elected by shareholders. There's not a company in America, other than maybe an occasional company that's subject to a takeover battle, that offers shareholders a real choice of candidates in an election. The number of directors that are voted on by shareholders is identical to the number of seats that are available. We don't think that's a very democratic way to run businesses. It doesn't give shareholders any real rights to select the leaders of their companies. And so last year we filed a resolution with the insurance company American International Group asking for them to put up more director candidates than there were nominees, than there were seats to be filled, so that shareholders would have a real choice. They would be able to choose what kinds of people they'd want to be involved in leadership of companies. You mentioned in your question that most of the directors in the United States are peer CEOs. We don't think that's a very good check and balance, on particularly on issues of CEO pay, because what CEO is going to walk into another CEO's boardroom and say, "We think your pay is too high"? They would turn around and face the same sort of questions in their own boardroom and have their own pay cut. In other countries that the U.S. competes with, particularly Germany and Japan, there are employee representatives often on boards, community representatives, customers, and it gives a very different flavor to the set of discussions that go on in the boardrooms. And one of the things we see, particularly in the year of CEO pay, is in Germany and Japan, the pay levels are far less. The typical CEO in Germany makes only about 30 times what the average worker does, instead of the 475 times that occurs in the United States.
This actually brings up, for me, a lot of parallels between the board election process and our own recent national election. But specifically, I'm wondering about shareholder knowledge of all this. Do shareholders generally tend to realize how little influence they have?
I don't think so. I think one thing is that shareholders don't, many shareholders don't take very seriously their role and right and responsibility to be involved in the governance process. One of the particular areas we're concerned about is mutual funds, which own a greater and greater share of stock in America, as they become the vehicle that most people invest in through their 401ks and IRAs and things like that. Mutual funds, very few mutual funds, only about a dozen or so, report to shareholders how they vote on their shareholder proxies. They're acting in the name of your listeners, but they don't give any information about how they're voting for these various resolutions of election of directors and environmental resolutions and human rights resolutions and a whole host of other things. We've issued a call called the Investors' Right to Know to ask mutual fund companies to publicly disclose their voting records, to put it on the Internet, to show people how they're acting in their name. And we think that's a would be a very revealing thing for most shareholders to know what is being done with their money and in their name.
Now, given the call for campaign finance reform, the broad call that has gone on in many ways all across the country for, well, in recent times anyway, the Responsible Wealth Program is also involved in that, calling for reports on political contributions, showing exactly where corporations get their influence in government.
Right. We filed two resolutions this past year, one with Microsoft and one with General Electric, asking them both to disclose who they gave campaign finance contributions to, and also, I think more importantly, what rationale and decision-making process they have gone through in allocating shareholder money to those candidates. I think shareholders deserve a right, or deserve to know what return on investment they're getting for that, what value the companies see in those investments. We've also called for them to publicly disclose their lobbying positions on campaign finance reform legislation, both at the federal and state level. We think it's important to have companies on the record about where they stand on this. There have been a half a dozen or so large companies that have publicly disavowed themselves from making these soft money contributions, campaign contributions, and we'd like to see more companies join that small list of leaders who are trying to affect some change in campaign finance issues.
And also on corporate welfare issues, which come under the same heading. Corporate welfare in general seems a little bit hazy to me, and probably to the average citizen who's listening right now, too. There are, of course, some concrete examples, but for the most part, it's really hard to pin down exactly where it's happening, how, and why.
Yeah, it's a very wide and growing thing. Time magazine, in the end of 1998, did an excellent four-part expose on the corporate welfare question, and they concluded that the federal government gives $125 billion a year of corporate welfare. We worked out the math on it, and that works out to about a little less than 25% of total corporate earnings in America is represented by corporate welfare. We got the idea to try and find out more about this by filing shareholder resolutions, both because we think we wanted to the public to become aware of how much of corporate profits and the corporate success is because of the public subsidy and public investment in large corporations. But we also think as shareholders that shareholders should understand how much of earnings are involved in receipts from the government and things that could go away through changes in the political process or changes of the political wind. Given the way the election has just turned out, it doesn't appear that's likely in the next couple of years. But we think there's significant growing public concern about corporate welfare, and it creates a risk for companies that are overly dependent on it.
Scott, I have one last question for you, and that relates back to just the segment of the population that is essentially the primary beneficiary of economic inequality in America. What kind of backlash do you receive, well, from your own, from the people that you're working with?
Well, we don't receive any backlash from the people we're working with. They are an unusual a lot in terms of people being in the top 5% by income or assets who are in favor of doing things to close the economic divide in America. They're business owners who support living wage campaigns. They're shareholders who support controlling corporate CEO pay. And they're upper-income taxpayers who are in favor of progressive taxes. It doesn't create tensions among our members, although other people who are in the same economic class do wonder why we're advocating this way. And the answer, I think, is pretty simple. Most of our members don't vote just their own economic self-interest. They try to understand what it means to be a part of a larger society, and they don't want their children and grandchildren being raised in a society where more and more people are living behind gates to protect themselves, and a society where people are cut off from one another because of this growing disparity between haves and have-nots. So they're really trying to create a society that they want their children and grandchildren to live in, that they want to retire in, and that's the real motive for acting.
I want to thank you for your time today, and is there anywhere listeners can go to get more information on responsible wealth?
Sure. They can go to our website, which is www.responsiblewealth.org, or they can give us a call at 617-423-2148.